NPR's Tom Gelton. Tom Gelton is a familiar voice to regular listeners of NPR. He has reported from far corners of the globe, including Central Europe and South America. He's written 5 books with topics as diverse as Sarajevo, Cuba, and immigration. His current beat for NPR is a broad one: religion, faith, and belief. What many listeners may not know is that Tom Gelton started his career in Maine as a public school teacher on North Haven Island. Gelton is back in Maine today for a conference on immigration being held in Portland, and we are pleased he has stopped by our studio for Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. As you watch world events unfold, are you thinking about the role of religion? Does your faith or belief system influence how you will vote in the election? Join our discussion with Tom Gelton next on Maine Calling. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Tom Gelton's voice is familiar to public radio listeners. Recently, you've heard his extensive reporting on the role of faith in America and around the world. He joins us today to talk about his reporting career, his new beat covering faith and politics, and his connections to our state. Tom Gelton, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Back to Maine. Yeah, it's great to be back here, Jennifer.
As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What questions do you have about what Tom has learned from his reporting in Latin America or Central America, or about the, Central Europe, or about the intersection of faith and politics? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. This is so fun to have you here in the studio. I know you're not in Maine very often, and I just wanted to start by talking about your beat, and I'm going to read from the NPR website here the description of your beat. Tom Gelton reports on religion, faith, and belief for NPR News, a beat that encompasses such areas as the changing religious landscape in America, the formation of personal identity, the role of religion in politics, and conflict arising from religious differences. That's one heck of a beat. And I wonder,
it's pretty highfalutin, isn't it?
Well, it pretty broad.
I have to say, I wrote it, actually.
I'm wondering just sort of the concrete question, how do you determine what stories to do every day or every week?
The advantage of writing a description of a beat so broadly is it basically allows me to do anything I want.
I see. Well done. How do you determine what you want to do? I mean,
I do the stories that sort of interest me intellectually. I mean, we are, over the last couple of years, we've been so swamped by news that it's actually hard to get on the air, particularly with a beat like mine, which is softer. And it means I do more feature news. It means that I'm not under a lot of pressure to do a lot of pieces because there's such competition for airtime. This allows me to sort of select those stories that interest me, that kind of capture my attention, that are, you know, interesting to me intellectually. I have a lot of experience doing hard news, and I think that one of the things I try to do is to look at the news from a different perspective. You know, I try to find kind of an angle on some of the big news stories, kind of a religion and faith angle, and it's not hard to find, Jennifer. I mean, like, almost everything that you hear about, that you think about, has in some ways, you know, something to do with people's sort of need to define themselves, to, you know, about culture, about faith, about belief. I mean, it's always there.
Mm-hmm. You told me you just now have come to Maine directly from Montgomery, Alabama. What were you doing in Alabama?
So, yeah, I'm working on a project that's not going to be on the air for at least a month. So I'm giving your listeners kind of a preview of it, a project about the role that U.S. Christianity has played in race relations, whether you call it white supremacy, racism. The truth is that if you look back over the last 150 years, the white church in particular has a lot to answer for in terms of shaping our attitudes about race and race relations in this country. I'm going to be exploring that and also looking into the ways that churches can promote racial reconciliation. But so it's It's a big project about the relationship between Christianity and race. I was just in Montgomery, Alabama. Montgomery, Alabama is just a remarkable place. It's the cradle of the Confederacy, and it's also the birthplace of the Civil Rights Movement. So it's sort of all wrapped up there. And I'm looking there. I was looking in particular at white evangelical churches and, you know, their somewhat troubled relationship with race issues over the years. I'm going to be going a couple of other places in the South. I'm going to be going to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I'm going to be going down to South Carolina. In South Carolina, for example, I'm profiling a very famous Presbyterian theologian from the 19th century who was himself a slave owner and was well known for justifying slavery from a Christian point of view. Mm. And so I'm going to be exploring how in the world can you, as a Presbyterian minister and theologian, justify slavery. That's kind of the foundation of this problematic relationship between Christianity and race that I'm going to be exploring in some detail.
Will this be a series of stories?
It'll be probably a series of four or five stories. And we have a podcast on issues of race and identity called Code Switch. Mm-hmm. And the Code Switch producers are going to let me have an entire episode. So we're going to do both long form and sort of feature form.
Oh, great. Well, you know, one of your most recent stories came from Syria, all of us watching in horror as events unfold in Syria. And your perspective is unique because you've been a war correspondent, but you're also now focusing on religion. Talk to me about this recent story, because it touched on how religion's playing a role on the Syrian-Turkey border, but also how what President Trump did, his decision, how it's affecting evangelical support for him. It's so interesting how it's all intertwined.
Well, I've been following. I mean, one of the big things that people call attention to is the fact that 81% of white evangelicals supported Donald Trump in the last election. And you know, people are always wondering, how do you explain that, given his somewhat less than religious profile, shall we say? But this is one issue where there is a real sharp rupture between evangelical Christians and Donald Trump, because what this operation has done by allowing Turkey to come into Syria and go after the Kurds, it has really jeopardized the situation of the few remaining Syrian Christians and Kurdish Christians in northern Syria. There's only about 40,000 at the most. There were only about 40,000 left before this started. They've been fleeing out of there in fear of the advancing Turkish forces. And U.S. Christians, you know, are upset. They're upset because they have seen the persecution of Christians in that region for a long time. And almost to a person, the leaders of the evangelical Christian community have criticized President Trump for doing this because they worry about the effect it'll have on Christian experience there. So this is one of those kind of rare points of rupture between the Christian community and the Trump administration.
Domestically, how do you see religion playing out in the upcoming presidential campaign? Let's start with the Democratic primary and then move on to the general election. How big of a part will it play?
I think we haven't figured that out yet, Jennifer. And one of the reasons is, let's say this kind of delicately, you know, we've known for a long time about the religious right. I mean, it was sort of organized under Jerry Falwell in the early 1980s and threw its support behind Ronald Reagan. Prior to that, evangelical Christians in particular were not easily classified as supporting either Republicans or Democrats. They had their own interests that, you know, beginning with the formation of the Moral Majority and the religious right, you saw this alliance with the Republican Party. More recently, you've had sort of the emergence of a religious left, you know, that has sort of rallied more around social justice issues. And I did a story recently, and now the candidates, the Democratic candidates, have all been pretty much, I think it's fair to say, on the left. I did a story recently pointing out that there is a big section of faith-based voters who are up for grabs. I call them the religious middle. They're not necessarily super conservative, but they have qualms about things like abortion and, you know, social issues, same-sex marriage. And there's a big group of them, faith voters, that neither party and no candidates have really gotten yet. And that's one of the things that I'm kind of curious to see, whether, you know, where they come down.
Okay. And when we look at the general election, a lot of people believe that President Trump won the evangelical vote last time because it was really about the Supreme Court. And it was really about abortion. Does this, I guess this is a multi-pronged question, does this recent rupture affect that? And does that support stay with the president when you look at the field of Democratic candidates and you see that they're all pro-choice?
That's the big question. I think, you know, for example, if we take the Syria thing. There are two issues that have really sort of weakened the Trump evangelical alliance. The first one is immigration, because a lot of evangelical Christians take their faith obligations pretty seriously in terms of welcoming the stranger. I mean, there's so much in Scripture about the need to welcome the stranger. And the very hard line that this administration has taken on immigration issues has actually cost it some support in the evangelical world. Not enough to make a difference, I don't know. And now we've seen sort of another, as they say, another point of conflict with this administration around its Syria policy. Whether these, and then, you know, then you can throw in all the questions about Donald Trump's own personal morality. Whether any of these are going to make a difference, I don't know, because what I heard in 2016 in covering this is so many evangelical Christians saw this as a lesser of two evils mm-hmm. choice. There was a lot of opposition to Hillary Clinton around, you know, a variety of issues. And I think to the extent that 2020 is once again seen for many of them as a lesser of evils question, it's going to be hard to predict. But, you know, there are differences between evangelical voters and this administration. I don't want to downplay that.
Can someone who does not go to church win a presidential election in the United States of America?
Well, he did.
But he makes a show of going to church.
Not that much of a show. I mean, I think that, you know, the evangelical leaders that I've spoken to don't try to defend Donald Trump as a very good role model for church-going Christians. They don't make that effort. They sort of say, I mean, there's some who are famous for saying that I think they see themselves, Jennifer, in a kind of a culture war right now, in a battle for the future of culture in this country. They see the forces of what they call secularism sort of being dominant. They worry that they are losing out. And they actually want a leader who kind of will go to war on their behalf. And whether he has moral failings, whether he's a regular churchgoer or not, is less important than the fact that he's able to sort of lead that charge. And that's what they say they want.
On another subject, Tom Jelton, you started your career on North Haven Island in Maine as a school teacher. And I, this morning, uncovered something you wrote about this experience. This appears to be a Department of Education publication, is this right? Which you authored?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I actually, here's the story. We had North Haven. North Haven, as many of your listeners know, is a small island. We had a lot of problems with scarce resources there. We were trying to educate. We had, when I was a teacher there, we had about 80 kids from kindergarten through 12th grade. So we had to do a lot with a little, and we were always looking for more support. And I was the principal at that time, and I got a grant. I was able to get a grant from the Department of Education for some extra resources. And in return, they said, you have to write a booklet about the special problems of schooling in geographically and culturally isolated communities. And I had a background, Jennifer, in journalism. I was sort of headed on that path before I became a school teacher. And I saw this as an opportunity to kind of like get a lot of things off my chest. So I ended up writing a little book. It was called Schooling in Isolated Communities. It was technically sort of fulfilling this demand from the education department that we provide some guidelines. But I took it a couple of steps further, and I turned it into a little book. It actually, interestingly enough, it became sort of a, if I can say so myself, kind of a cult classic. Because at that time, in the late 70s, there was a lot of interest in issues of rural education. And after writing that book, I became sort of a important person in Alaska. I spent a lot of time in Alaska teaching, working with schools in rural Alaska and Bush Alaska. I did a lot in Appalachia. I actually went to Europe. The OECD hired me as a consultant, and I went all over rural Europe. So it just happened to, that little book came out at a time when there was a lot of interest in sort of the special problems of rural, small rural schools, and I took it for all it was worth.
Well, what's so interesting to me, I obviously didn't have time to read the whole booklet this morning, but a passage jumped out at me, and if you'll indulge me, I'm going to read it to you, because what strikes me about this passage is that it sort of foreshadows the kind of work you would do for the next 40 years. You write, North Haven has, of course, always been an island, but it has not always been isolated, at least not in the way it is now. At one time, the United States was a nation of communities. Most people lived in the country and were part of a community of people. Even those that lived in cities were grouped in small communities. Each had its own tradition and cultural character. The individual who left his community never to return was the exception rather than the rule. We are no longer such a country. There are still communities, but for most Americans, the sense of identity that came from belonging to a community has been lost. It is in its place as a feeling of membership in a broader tradition, regional or national. You've been reporting on this kind of stuff ever since.
Yeah, you could say, you know, the truth is, Jennifer, I studied anthropology in college, and I was always very interested in this issue. And just to very briefly go into anthropological literature, there was an anthropologist named Robert Redfield who wrote about the small tradition and the great tradition. And he was saying that societies always have both traditions. They have sort of this big national tradition, and they have a small tradition. And you know, and that varies. And that was one of the things that really sort of struck me in North Haven, is that you had a very powerful small tradition with a much weaker connection to the large tradition. And that's been an issue in rural life. You know, right, this has got a lot of resonance right now, because one of the themes that we saw especially play out in 2016 and 2018 was a growing urban-rural divide. And very much a divergence of worldviews between people living in rural areas and people living in urban areas. And of course, an increasing share of the population lives in urban areas now. But and speaking of culture war, you know, we're now seeing this kind of culture conflict between rural America and urban America. And you know, that was some taste of it 40 years ago in North Haven.
It's so interesting, because what we're talking about here is related to something we were talking about yesterday. I'm sure you don't know this, but yesterday's main calling was about fake news. And our guest, Chet Lunner, who'd been the editor of several newspapers, was talking about a local newspaper, the Biddeford Journal Tribune, which has just folded, and talking about how the newspaper was such the center of community. And now, and the reporter that reported the story was somebody that people in the community knew. And then as small newspapers have been folding, the information is now not only more diverse, but also you're going with your tribe, and you're following, you're not following the local news tradition. You're following what national outlet you most agree with already. You know, Chet said it much more. It's just so related to your thoughts about community on North Haven, the way that you're following religion and faith, and how this is influencing elections.
Right. I think that's one of the saddest things about journalism is the demise of local news organizations, local newspapers, local TV, radio operations, news operations, and being taken over by a big conglomerate. So, you know, where you do see local newspapers continuing, they're often owned by some big, you know, media conglomerate who, like, shapes their news. So it's not shaped by a local publisher anymore, by the local reporters. It's shaped by some, as you say, some distant national organization. Can I say that the one bright spot in this regard is actually the public radio system? Because here in public radio, we have 800 stations around the country, and some of the strongest local news reporting in the country is now coming out of public radio stations. They are carrying that torch.
We're speaking with Tom Gelton, but you already knew that because you recognized his voice. If you have a question for him, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Farmland Trust. celebrating 20 years of growing the future for farming. Share your stories and get involved at MaineFarmlandTrust20th.org. Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine energy audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And the First Church of Christ Scientist Portland, where you can hear about a new view of God and its effect on well-being on Friday, October 25th at 7 p.m.
It's unprecedented for the children of a president to be working for a business that enriches them and the president while in office.
It's not just adult children trying to enrich themselves thanks to their connection to a president.
The ethical questions that come from this arrangement this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up today between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Every single person gets angry at some point, but who actually gets to express it?
Who gets to be angry with power? Who gets to be angry with recognition? Who gets to be angry with accolades?
Ideas on the different sides of anger. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 1 and again Wednesday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Tom Jelton is here with me. He reports on religion, faith, and belief for NPR. He was a pioneering foreign correspondent for NPR. He is the author of 5 books. He's in Portland today as the keynote speaker at a conference on migration and integration. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I ought to update the script. It says you're the author of 5 books, but now that we know about the book you wrote when you were on North Haven Island, we should say 6.
I think that's 1 of the 5.
Yeah, okay. I'll start with an email here from Reverend Duncan Newcomer. He studies the spiritual life of Abraham Lincoln. He writes, "The face of religion in America is changing, and while church and state are separate, religion and politics are not. To me, Abraham Lincoln is a trailblazer for a secular sacred voice. For example, his Thanksgiving Day proclamation was seemingly religious, but totally secular, yet gratitude and humility were the spiritual values he promoted in it. Do you see places and ways that that secular sacred spirit is surfacing in America today?"
The very notion of a kind of a sacred slash secular combination is rare. You know, it seems like you're either on the secular side or you're on the spiritual side. And the idea that that Abraham Lincoln sort of embodied a kind of a sacred spiritual combination is to me really interesting. I'm eager to read this book. It sounds fascinating. I think that goes to, you know what it goes to, Jennifer? It goes to this notion of what does the separation of church and state mean. The First Amendment to the Constitution seems to be a little bit contradictory. On the one hand, it says that Congress shall pass no law establishing a religion, and Congress shall also establish no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. So, you know, which is it? Are people supposed to be free to exercise their religion, and does the state enforce that, or does the state stay out of it? I think that, you know, throughout our history, we've had a real hard time sort of trying to decide where to draw the line in that regard. We were talking before about some conservative Christians who feel that secularism itself is a kind of religion, mm-hmm. and that the government has sort of come down too heavily on the secular side. Attorney General Barr just gave a talk at Notre Dame within the last week or so, where he basically said that he, you know, he thinks that the government should not be endorsing secularism. Those people who believe strongly in the separation of church and state, so that is exactly what church-state separation means, that the government, the state, should not be aligned with any religion and should be aligned with no religion, should in a sense be aligned with sort of a secular view. You know, it's just something that we have been struggling with since the founding of the Republic, and I guess we're going to continue to struggle with it. And, you know, I think it may very well be I would agree with Professor Newcomer. I think that, you know, people like Abraham Lincoln, this didn't seem to be such a big issue in the first 100 years of the country. It's only been in more recent years that it's become a really big issue. I think Abraham Lincoln sort of was onto something there.
I have a tweet from Lucy. The Pew Research Center's research on religion in America shows that millennials identify as less religious than older generations. Why do you think that is? Have you done much reporting on religion and spirituality across generations?
Well, the data are absolutely clear on this. It's called the rise of the nones, N-O-N-E-S, the rise of the share of people who say that they have no religious affiliation at all. It's gone up dramatically, and it's gone up especially among millennials. The listener is absolutely right about that. Why is that? You know, I think it's the influence of, let's say it's the influence of social media. It's the fact that we have increasing diversity in this country. Young people are exposed to, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, it used to be that young people grew up in more of a bubble, kind of a cultural bubble, you know, in their own sort of world of religion and culture. And now young people are growing up, you know, whether it's, I mean, I was just at a conference this morning here in Portland, where the public schools are full of people from different faith traditions from all over the world. And when you're growing up exposed to so many different faith traditions and people from everywhere in the world, as opposed to your own tribe, your own religion, I guess it's natural that you're going to get a little bit more sort of questioning of, you know, do I just follow the faith of my parents, my family, or I, you know, do I look for something a little bit more kind of attuned to where I am at, you know? And so I think you get this more of an experimental approach to issues of faith and spirituality and identity in this generation than you did previously.
That's interesting. What about the scandals that they've grown up with in there? Is that sort of the background to their lives?
Yeah, well, I think that just to give one example, there's so many scandal examples, Jennifer, but the issue of sexual abuse within church communities, something we never talked about. It's something that's actually been there. We now know that it's been there forever, but only in like the last 20 years have we had this awareness of how much sexual abuse has been perpetrated, even by members of the clergy. We saw it first in the Catholic world. More recently, we have seen it in the evangelical world. And, you know, the rise of the Me Too movement and growing awareness of this stuff, you know, inevitably that's going to have an effect on young people. Do we really want to sort of align our, you know, identify? Can we identify with a tradition where sexual abuse is so rampant?
Lucy mentioned that millennials are less religious, but we're having this conversation in Maine. She's talking about demographically in terms of age, but demographically in terms of region, Maine often comes up on the list as last or near last in the number of people who either go to church or consider themselves religious or the importance of religion in their lives. Why do you think that is?
Well, I lived in Maine for 6 years. I'm actually originally from the Midwest. I lived in Maine for 6 years. I've since lived in California and Washington, D.C. and other places. So I have a little bit of a kind of a comparative perspective here. I know from my experience living in Maine that Mainers are really independent. Some would say stubborn. Mainers do not like to be put in a box. I think that the sort of the idea of free thinking is really rooted in the Maine character. I mean, you know, if you look at the history of Maine, it has been one where, you know, being sort of self-reliant and independent has been, you know, integral to the character. So that doesn't surprise me. I didn't really know that, but it doesn't surprise me.
We'll go to Kathy calling from Waldo. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hello, Tom Gelton. This past Monday was Indigenous Peoples Day. And on Wednesday, our Peace and Justice group showed a film called Doctrine of Discovery. Have you heard of that film?
No, I haven't heard of that film, Kathy. I know there's a new book out sort of about the kind of the theology of discovery, the whole notion of discovery being kind of tied up with sort of imperialist views of the world, the idea that, you know, that one group could, quote, discover, you know, some other part of the world. So it sounds like it's kind of a similar theme, but I'm not familiar with that, no.
about an hour long. And what it revealed to me is that when the Europeans came under the aegis of the king and the queen, in the case of Columbus, Isabella and Ferdinand, I think it was, they came with the imprimatur of the Pope of Rome, and he issued a papal bull saying that because the superior race of white Christians had discovered this land in the name of Christianity, all those who they met, the savages, the brown skins, whatever, they were subject to the rule of the superior people of Europe.
Right.
That meant that they may have a right to live on the land, but they had no right to own it, that it now belonged to the superior race of white Christians. So, yeah. You know, I did not know that. When I went to school, you know, it was like the Lone Ranger and the Indians relationship. And the schools did nothing to challenge that. So now, in my later years, I discover what our education system never taught us, something that important.
Yep.
Kathy, thank you so much for your call.
You know, Kathy, I don't know if you've ever been to Spain, but if you go to see some of the cathedrals in Spain, they're full of gold, and they're very beautiful, ornate cathedrals. If you know the history of the colonization of the New World, you will learn that that gold that you see on the ceilings and in the walls and in the statuary of these cathedrals in Spain was taken from Latin America, from Central America, from the Incas. The colonizers came over and enslaved the Indians and basically plundered their gold, and it ends up in churches in Spain and in also the Basilica of St. Peter in Rome. I mean, that was built as a beautiful, beautiful cathedral. You can't look at it the same way once you know that the precious stones that went to build it were actually plundered at great human cost in Latin America. There's a new book out that I highly recommend. It's called Silver Sword and Stone by Maria Rana, and it's a story of the sort of history of Latin America that is told largely through the prism of the colonization of Latin America. And it's really a sad story. I mean, Latin America was really scarred by that colonial experience, and it's dealing with that yet today.
Kathy, thank you for your call. We are going to take another quick break. If you have a question for Tom Gelton, give us a call sooner rather than later, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com. And the Finance Authority of Maine, providing financial solutions that help Maine people achieve their business and higher educational goals. FameMaine.com.
Last April, 18-year-old Anthony Vega Cruz was driving to get dinner when he was pulled over by police. On Next from the New England News Collaborative, a collision course between a teenager and an officer leads to a fatal shooting. Plus, we'll look at racial profiling and policing in New England, where a disproportionate number of black and brown drivers are pulled over for traffic violations.
We don't have any racial, any officers here that are racially profiling.
Please join us.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi on the prospect of impeachment.
If the Senate decides that they have better things to do that day, so they acquit. He's impeached forever if we go down that path. You are impeached forever should we go down that path.
Nancy Pelosi, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And that's tomorrow afternoon at 2 and Sunday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a conversation with NPR's Tom Jelton. He has reported on national and international news and currently focuses on religion and faith. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. We have a tweet from Larry. Is the link between faith and politics on the rise or decline?
Boy, that's an interesting question, whether it's rising or declining. I would say that I think we saw in 2016 sort of a high point that certainly I don't think that Donald Trump could have won in 2016 without that overwhelming support he got from white evangelicals. And I don't think he can be reelected in 2020 without that support. That's a pretty strong link. I think that his presidency depends on a very strong link with white evangelicals. I think whether that's true on the Democratic side or not is less apparent. The truth is that we know from data that Democrats, by and large, or people, liberals in general, people on the left, are far less religious than people on the right. So, you know, that could be a motivating factor on the right to a greater extent than it is on the left. On the other hand, you may feel sort of, if you're feeling sort of besieged by kind of all this religion talk, you may be motivated, you know, if you're an atheist or an agnostic or not, you know, a sort of unaffiliated person, you may be motivated, all the more motivated to go out and vote. So that's a kind of a, in itself, kind of a link between faith or unfaith and politics. But I do think that it has been very, very powerful in the last couple of election cycles.
We have an email from Sue. What have you discovered about interfaith work in America? Are there any particular communities that have achieved understanding among different religious groups? What do you think is important to foster this interfaith understanding?
You know what the fastest growing religion in America is right now? It's Islam. And it has just risen dramatically. And you're talking here about a faith tradition that very few Americans a few years ago were very familiar with. They really didn't know what Islam stood for, what Muslims believed in, how they lived their lives sort of in accordance with their faith. Muslims have been immigrating to this country in very high numbers in the last 20 years, and not just to urban centers. They've been, they've been everywhere. I mean, I was, believe it or not, I rode my bike across America last summer to celebrate a big birthday. And so I was riding through a lot of small towns all across America. And I found Muslims everywhere I went. I was just in Montgomery, as I said earlier, until last night. Everywhere you go in America, you're finding Muslims. And I think that this has been a really educative experience for many Americans. Talking about interfaith, they are learning about faith. Americans are learning about faith traditions. As a result of the growing diversity in our country, the growing multiculturalism, Americans are learning about faith traditions that were very alien and sort of unfamiliar to them previously.
Mm. You rode your bike across the country. What route did you take?
We started out in northwest Oregon, in Astoria, right below the Washington border, and we ended up not too far from here. We ended up in Seabrook, New Hampshire.
So you did a northern route.
Yeah, it was a northern
route. Okay, great. I'm going to go to Jordan, who's calling from Wilton. Hi, Jordan. Go ahead.
Hello. Good afternoon. I'm interested.
Jordan, you're hard to hear. Can you be a little
insight and understanding of religions that are actually doing something about environmental conservation, biodiversity conservation, and addressing climate change? Specifically, are there countries and peoples and religions and faiths in the world today that are actually doing something good for the environment and for biodiversity in light of the climate change phenomenon and menace?
That's a really interesting question. In terms of denominations, And I'm sure you know this, Pope Francis has been very outspoken about sort of the Christian obligation to take care of the planet, and has made advocacy of good environmental thinking really important. So we see that. Obviously, and there are some sort of more liberal Protestant denominations that are also raising that issue. One of the stories that I'm most interested in pursuing, and I hope to get a chance to do it over the next year, is the importance of indigenous religion around the world. I mean, indigenous peoples sort of are kind of losing some of their traditions. But if you look at kind of indigenous religion, that's where you're going to find the highest consciousness of environmental protection, because they are, indigenous religions are very oriented to the earth and see the earth in spiritual terms to a greater extent than sort of mainline faith traditions. So that's actually a link that I would be really interested in pursuing. I mean, you know, you see this to some extent in this country, out in North Dakota, where you know, tribal groups there have been sort of the most impassioned advocates of preserving the environment against like pipelines and so forth. But it's also true in Africa and in many other places where indigenous groups are in the forefront of the fight to deal with climate change.
An email from Jean: does the strong public image that churches follow Trump, no matter what unchristian response he comes up with, have the effect of driving people away from religion? She's wondering if, because churches are seem to support the president, that people don't want to have anything to do with churches.
Well, that's a reminiscent of a call we had earlier about, you know, we were talking about whether it's the scandals, whether scandals have driven people away from their own faith traditions. You know, I mean, I suppose that's true for people that don't like Trump. You know, that could drive, if you don't like Trump and you see churches sort of embracing Trump, that might, you know, that might lead you to sort of have less faith in your own churches. But if you do like Trump, you know, that's, you know, and you're religious, then that's not going to be a factor.
We have an email from Karen, spelled with an I. Please tell Tom Jelton that alums from Forest City High School, now living in Maine, say hello. Karen, married to Alan Belsheim.
Well, we're going way back now. I thought it was bad enough we're going back to North Haven. We're going back all the way back to my childhood in Iowa. That is a long time back. But I knew the Belsheims. I remember the Belsheims growing up. So glad to hear that there's some Forest City people living here in Maine.
We'll go to Jim calling from Auburn. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering. I've heard in the past that the evangelicals have been really putting a lot of emphasis on putting chaplains into the military. And is that true, that in the past 10 years there's been a huge influx of evangelicals within the military chaplain service?
Interesting question. Thanks, Jim. And do you know?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that there's been a lot of controversy in the military about what attitude the military should have towards, not just towards its chaplains, but towards sort of religious belief and religious practice in general. You know, there have been some very conservative chaplains in the military who have sort of promoted their faith pretty boldly and created a lot of controversy. Military branches have to tread very carefully in this area, and some critics have said that they haven't been careful enough, that they have sort of been too eager to promote Christianity, for example. I don't know the answer as to whether there's an increase in the number of chaplains. If you're talking about chaplains as members of the uniform military, you know, there are set kind of formulas that such and such a unit is entitled to however many chaplains. That's established as far as the kind of the system is concerned. And so I doubt very much that the military has like increased the number of billets for chaplains or decreased the number of billets for chaplains. Those are set. You know, there are formulas that govern that kind of thing.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. Jerry on Facebook says, a caller just asked, are the religions doing something about the environment, climate change? I'd like to note that the new goddess and other modern nature religions are extremely concerned about the natural environment. They need to be given credit for their stance. And an email from Paul. In today's divisive world, what does religious faith have to offer? How can a person have faith without simply exacerbating division and divisiveness?
Well, I'm not here to sort of advocate for having a faith or not having a faith. I think that, you know, we've been around as a species for hundreds of thousands of years, and people have always sort of felt a need to sort of explain the mysteries of life. And you know, faith has played a very important role in the human experience forever. And, you know, some people, there have been some sociologists that have argued over the years that as we develop economically and socially, you know, that religion will disappear. The truth of it is, it hasn't disappeared. There was something called the secularization thesis that said that as societies develop economically and so forth, that they become more secular. But, you know, here we are in 2019, and there's still an awful lot of people for whom faith is really important.
We'll go to David in Kennebunkport. Hi, David. Go ahead. And if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Hey, okay. I can be really quick. Hi, Tom. I'm a 70-year-old nerd. I didn't know I was until 20 minutes ago, but thank you for that. I'm just wondering if you could do a quick run-through on the seven deadly sins and see if there are any that Trump hasn't committed on a daily basis. Thanks.
Boy, I was not expecting that. I'm the religion reporter, and I'm supposed to know what are the seven deadly sins. Let's see, sloth is one, I believe, right?
Gluttony, avarice, lust.
Yeah, help me out here, Jennifer.
I can't remember them all. But
I don't even remember where they came from. And the question was, you know, whether Donald Trump is guilty. Is that what it was, David?
I don't think we have time for a dissertation, David, but thanks for your call. And I think your point is well taken. And we'll go to Richard in Leeds. And Richard, again, if you could be quick, that would be great.
Sure. I disagree with Tom about the First Amendment. The reason the Founding Fathers made this separation of church and state was because of all of the problems that had been going on in Europe for many, many years because of people's, you know, when the Catholics were in charge, they beheaded the people who were against them. And, you know, so there was this constant back and forth going on of Protestants and Catholics and Jews and whatnot. So anyway, the Founding Fathers, they definitely wanted to have church completely out of government. They just wanted people to be able to practice.
Richard, I want to give Tom a chance to respond here. Go ahead.
No, I don't disagree with that, Richard, so I don't know where our disagreement is. But, I mean, my point was that they put in two clauses. They also, they certainly made that clear, but they also put in this clause that Congress should make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. And the way that that has been interpreted is that it's not just a matter of being free to worship in your church of your choice, but being able to exercise your faith out in public, you know, praying in public and so forth. And I think that just arguing from the devil's advocate point of view, I think some of the, you know, what you're hearing right now is that a lot of, you know, very religious people feel that they don't have the option or the approval of the state to kind of exercise their faith in public. That's kind of the other half of mm-hmm. that provision.
So interesting. Thank you, Richard. Sneak in a last quick email from Dan. I'm curious if you see any similarities in the gun rights advocates in America and the evangelical traditions. Both seem to have a huge impact, both negative and positive, in American society, but both have trouble admitting to the well-documented negative influence in society.
Well, I think what they have in common is a real deep distrust of the government and distrust of the state. And that sort of compels gun owners to feel that they need to, for some reason, be able to have the right to arm themselves. And I think a lot of evangelicals, you know, feel that the government is not necessarily on their side. And so, you know, there are, I think, some elements in common sort of in the worldview of these two groups.
All right. Well, Tom Chelton, thank you so much. We could be talking about this topic for a long, long time. Looking forward to your reporting that you were telling us about the intersection of race and faith and religion, especially in rural communities in America. That's Tom Chelton, a longtime reporter for NPR. He covers religion and was a pioneering foreign correspondent as well, and is the author of several books. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Our theme was composed by Mike Jandrow. Today's program will be again tonight at 8. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.